I'm delighted to welcome Lisa Falco, an AI and data consultant with experience in health and femtech. Lisa is the author of a book called Go Figure, The Astonishing Science of the Female Body, and a Forbes contributor on women's health. Her work at the intersection of technology and healthcare has been instrumental in advancing our understanding of the female body. And we are very eager to hear her insights today. Welcome, Lisa.
Well, Lisa, it's such an honor to have you on the podcast. And I just would like to share with the audience how I found you. I had the honor to be at your workshop at the Femtechnology Summit in Roche in Basel last June. And, after all the presentation, the discussion we had, I thought, okay, I need Lisa to be on the podcast. So I'm extremely glad you accepted my invitation and would love to start really talking about women's health and the massive gap in data specifically that we see.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. It was really a nice event, I think, in Basel as well. There was so many interesting discussions. It's amazing to see all the new femtech companies that are coming up and trying to improve the conditions for women's health. So it was an exciting event.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it would be great as a starting point if you can tell us, you know, women's health data gap and what is the underlying problem. And one of the data points that we discussed in the summit was that, you know, 30 years ago, women still could not be part of clinical research, which is such a staggering data point. And basically, it's just hard to believe, isn't it? So we have been out of the equation for studying conditions and treatments for so long. Can you give us a bit of background around that and that for all the gaps we see now in certain conditions and treatments affecting female-specific health conditions?
Yeah, well, the origin of that women were not included in many, not of course not in all the clinical trials, but in many of the clinical trials was basically to protect women. So it was not, you know, to suppress them or to be, you know, wanting to exclude them, but people were worried that they might be pregnant and that could somehow harm the clinical trials, could harm the fetus and so on. That was one of the reasons. And another reason why they were excluded was also that it seemed like such a big complication to have our fluctuating hormones, because you could not really be sure how the drug would be influenced by the hormones. And this is another reason that we were excluded from the clinical trial. But of course, the consequence of that is that the final drugs were not adapted to women. So they would simply assume that we were smaller versions of men with pesky hormones. But that is, of course, not at all the case. We're actually fundamentally different. We have a different body composition. We have a higher percentage of body fat. We have different enzymes. We basically digest drugs differently and react differently in almost all medical conditions.
Wow. I mean, it's helpful to understand a bit more, you know, as to why this happened. But obviously this has an impact, right, on the data. And I wanted to ask you if there are any examples of conditions or treatments that were actually tested in men, but for women's health. Do we have any examples of that?
Really, for women's health, then no. For instance, in diseases that are much more prevalent in women, for instance, osteoporosis, then there's actually more research that has been done in women. So it's not all bad, but there are other cases, for instance, with the sleeping drug Ambien, for instance, that was only tested in men. And then actually took quite a while to realize that women got very, I mean, the drug stayed in their blood much, much longer than it did in men. So there were many accidents the day after taking this drug because the women were still sleepy. And most of the drugs, actually I think it's about 80% of the drugs that FDA had to retract from the market. They had, because of the bad side effects, 8 out of 10 of such drugs, they were actually had much worse side effects on women than they had on men. So it's something that we've seen quite a lot in the past.
Wow. Yeah, quite shocking. But yeah, so I guess then around, you know, the topic of today, right? The data gap, right? And still around female conditions. So it seems like there's still a long way to go. And I would love to have your perspective as to where are we in this journey, right? Are we catching up? More and more research are covering women, but it's more about what's your perspective?
Yes, I think we're seeing a lot of progress on this behalf. And also since 2016, you're actually not allowed, you won't get any funding if you don't include both a men and women in your clinical trials, if you're doing research that needs external funding. It is not mandatory yet in pharma, but the awareness in pharma is really growing and increasing a lot. So we're seeing a lot of positive changes. And I also see, I think that all those femtech startups that we see booming, they are really providing a lot of new knowledge, a lot of new awareness that will make a big change for women's health in the long run. So I think we're on a very positive slope, but of course it's going to take a long time to catch up for sure. So, but we are moving in the right direction.
Yeah, it's encouraging, it's promising. And, you know, I believe it's not only on women's health and data. It's also, you know, overall diversity, and the FDA recently also put that more into perspective, you know, like different minority groups or underrepresented and ethnical backgrounds. But yeah, we are, you know, on the right track. And now let's jump more into, you know, during the life cycle of women, what happens to the body, right? We go through a lot of hormonal changes, and that can be from menstrual cycle to pregnancy to then menopause. Could you give us a bit of, you know, an overview as to what happens? What are these cycles?
So in the menstrual cycle, if we do it very, very simplified, you have in the first half of the menstrual cycle, you have a lot of estrogen that is helping your follicles to mature, and one of them will turn into an egg, and this is happening under the influence of estrogen. And in just after the ovulation, which happens somewhere in the middle of the menstrual cycle, then the progesterone will start to increase. So the second part of the menstrual cycle, you have quite high progesterone levels. These levels are change a lot. They have a big influence on your mood, for instance. So estrogen normally makes you more extroverted, happy, because it helps the production of serotonin. And progesterone helps you calm down often to feel a bit more relaxed. So when that is high, for most women, for some women it's different, but it's important that we're all individual and we all react differently. So you can't say this is really the same for all women, but on average, this is the tendencies that we're seeing. And what happens if you then get pregnant, you get the same hormones that increase up to 300 times more. So you have estrogen getting really, really high over the whole pregnancy, and you have progesterone getting really, really high. And this, in some women, this really helps them feeling happy and glowing over the pregnancy. But other women react a bit badly to this, and that makes them feel quite the opposite and unhappy during it. But what they all have in common is that at the end of the pregnancy, when the placenta is being ejected after giving birth, this production of hormones just stops suddenly overnight. And that means you have a huge drop in the hormones, which of course, has a big influence on your serotonin production. So you're used to having very high levels of serotonin, which is the happiness hormone. And when that suddenly disappears overnight, most women, I mean, 80% of women, they develop something called baby blues, which is really a feeling of sadness and feeling down just after giving birth. And this is a similar phenomena that is that you see on a much smaller scale during the menstrual cycle. There you also have this PMS and the last 2 days of the menstrual cycle, where both progesterone and estrogen are falling down quite steeply. You can get this these negative emotions as well. And same also happens during menopause or perimenopause, where you have a much more irregular production of hormones. This has a big influence on your mood as well. So these are very sensitive times in terms of mental health. So it's important times really to take care of yourself, making sure you don't have too much stress, because it even further breaks down the serotonin.
Very, very interesting, actually, right? And the connection, right, with well-being and mental health that you were mentioning. And it seems that in terms of, for example, perimenopause, you touched briefly on that one. You know, many women wonder when it starts, why, what are the main symptoms, but it seems like we still don't quite know, right? So I would like us now to zoom in a little bit as to what are the challenges that we still don't know about women's health, right? Affect 50% of the population, and we still maybe don't have yet the answers to that.
Yes, I mean, it's very difficult with perimenopause because we have no clear definition, and it's, you know, small. In the beginning, it can be small imbalances or changes in the menstrual cycle. And there's just something that is a bit off. And how do you even measure that? I mean, there is no way of diagnosing it, but it's an open question if it is something that should be diagnosed, because it's also not a disease. It's actually a natural progression. So you're naturally moving into, I mean, menopause is the moment where you stop having your menstrual cycle, but perimenopause is can be up to 10 years before that you start not being so regular anymore. so that is, I mean, that is definitely one of the big mysteries with regards to women's health. Then, of course, something that is completely understudied as well is how we react to drugs when in the different hormonal phases, when you have more or less of certain hormones, can you take up the drug the same way, or is it somehow altered? Because the cells are, every cell, or not maybe every cell, but many of the cells in the body are influenced by the presence of these hormones in the blood. And that could actually have an influence on how you manage to digest drugs, etc. And this is another area where we simply don't know much at all about. So
what can we do, right, to actually contribute to this? And you touched a bit early about, you know, measurable data, right? And I'm wondering, does this data come from reported outcomes from women? Does this data come from biomarkers? Does this data come from, you know, I'm just trying to picture here the different sources that we can also measure. And here I would love now to start transitioning to, you know, data, the impact, the role of data for this. I mean, you are the expert of this, so I would love to get your perspective on this specific topic.
It's very hard to say that you're an expert in data, because data is so vast. It can be anything, right? So I cannot say maybe I'm an expert how to treat the data afterwards, but the data can come from It can come from clinical trials. It can really be, you know, studying the cells in details. You can study microbiomes in the gut. You can study the vaginal microbiome. You can study proteomics. Data can be collected from surveys, just simply having women track how they feel in different phases of the menstrual cycle. You can measure your vitals, for instance, how we know that heart rate and breathing rate and temperature, these are all vitals that are influenced by the hormones, and they change over the menstrual cycle. They change when you get pregnant. So these are things you can track as well. And then, of course, the big challenge is, how do you deal with all this data? How do you analyze it? How do you use it to actually extract knowledge about yourself or about the population or a patient? And that is a bit the promise of AI, right? That is a means of being able to analyze a much larger mass of data, because the human brain is very good at pattern recognition. So it's not that it's not doing that well, but we may be able to analyze to link together three or four different of those parameters, whereas AI can link together 20, 30, or hundreds of different parameters and being able to extract knowledge from that, if it's being collected in the right way. And there's, of course, a lot of challenges with that as well. And we have a long way to go. But in the future, this is pretty much the promise of personalized medicine and being able to provide a more personalized treatment for whether it's women or men or any kind of diversity group. We're going more towards a personalized medicine. It might take some time, but it's definitely one of the big promises of data and AI.
Well, you mentioned, right, the challenges of, you know, collecting all this data. I was wondering if harmonization of the data is one of the key challenges you see. I mean, we have all these, you know, wearables, all these devices, right? But they all measure so many parameters, right? But it's all about, okay, how, when we combine them, our models can read that, or, you know, it sounds quite complex. So it would be great if you could unpack this a little bit more for us.
It is very complex, and it's not harmonized at all. So and what's important is that a lot of this research is something that needs to be done in clinical studies, because you also need to track the outcome. So you can track all these, you can decide to track a certain number of parameters over time and see how you react. But then you also need to track the outcome, and the outcome would be, how do you react to a drug if you change these five parameters, or how are you feeling if all these parameters are changing in this way. So that's why it needs to be in a controlled environment to a large extent. It's very hard to do the research just on data that is out there, because we don't know what they mean, and we don't know what the effect of those data point has been on the human behind it. That's why we still need a lot of more fundamental research and clinical research.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly sounds very complex. And you mentioned something very interesting, right? That AI can do better than us, which is analyzing, right, all these hundreds of different data points and correlating them, right? The comorbidities that can come out of that. I personally find that very, very exciting, to be able to expand, broaden, right, the number of correlations and analysis we could do. And, you know, this is kind of a broad question, but I was obviously now just we're hearing about AI and ChatGPT and all that. There's a lot of attention. It's a good moment to actually be, you know, learning about it, putting controls on it. But how do you see in the next 5 to 10 years, research and specifically women's health, right? How do you envisage the world in terms of what I hope we will make progress on that, right? As you said earlier, we are on the right track. Mm-hmm. Are there any highlights or any specific views that you have for that?
I mean, one highlight, I think, is all the progress that is happening on the research of endometriosis. So endometriosis is a really painful condition that almost 10% of all women have, which makes them almost incapable of functioning normally due to their extreme pain when they have their period. And this is, I mean, this has been a traditionally very underexplored area. We just accepted that period pain is normal, but to this extent, it's actually not normal. It's due to this condition called endometriosis. And being able to properly diagnose this and to get to then get the treatment for it, this has been a huge gap in women's health. And at the moment, there are more and more companies that are working on this, both on the diagnostic side. It used to actually take, it could take up to 9 years to get diagnosed. And often you have to see 5 or 6 different doctors just to get the diagnosis. On that end, it's really, there's a lot of awareness that is improving, but also a lot of diagnostics tools that are coming. So this is very exciting. And not, of course, it's not enough to be diagnosed. You want the treatment for it. But that is also something that is coming. And it is, we're not there yet, but at least the interest is there. And I know France has even gone out and said this is a national priority for us to find a treatment for this, and that is amazing. I mean, this was totally unthinkable 20-30 years ago, so that is one really exciting part for the future, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, it sounds very exciting and very promising. And also, as you said earlier, right, we're seeing a lot of femtech startups exclusively focused on endometriosis at the moment, which is very, very exciting from both from a medical device perspective and also patient support, diagnosis, etc. Well, amazing. And actually, before I asked you, the personal question I asked to all my guests, I guess there's a last thought that just came up. And I remember in our workshop we did in Roche, we did an exercise that was super interesting, which is, you know, as women, when we go through, you know, public or private healthcare system, but our pathway mm-hmm. is probably very different, right? And you just mentioned this data point that endometriosis can take up to 9 years to diagnose. And on average, women have to go to different doctors, up to 5-6 doctors. I mean, it's definitely, in terms of pathway, right, also impactful in a way. And I wanted to ask you if you have any views also on data and how we can, you know, maybe modify, not radically change, but adapt this patient journey, essentially, for women, because it's very different for men, or might be different for men.
I think that one another promise of AI, if you like, it's the democratization of healthcare, right? Because today, when you go and see a doctor, you're very much dependent on the quality of the doctor, or like the knowledge of the doctor that you're seeing, and if she or he is competent or not, and well aware of the women's health issues. So what AI can do or can potentially do is to make sure that everyone gets a similar treatment as the best doctors, no matter if you're in Switzerland like myself, where we have, I think, one of the best healthcare systems and the best access to healthcare in the world. But if you then is in somewhere rural in a low income country where you have basically no access or very little access to healthcare, these solutions, these digital solutions, can really help in bringing that knowledge out to them and making sure that even those doctors that might not have the same capabilities or have not had the same training can still provide a really good care. So I'm quite optimistic that the democratization of healthcare will come through these digital solutions in the end. I'm not sure if that answered your question, but
yes, I mean, it definitely does, right? I mean, we need to democratize access, and just, you know, I was reflecting on this, that as a patient, right, we should all reflect about, okay, we have patients listening to this podcast right now, men, women, whoever they are, but think about, okay, just be conscious, right, of the different steps that might take them, but also have clinicians listening to this podcast right now. And it would be very interesting for them to maybe ask to think, hey, when you see women in consultation, maybe think a bit more about, you know, their hormonal changes, right? Or think about, be curious. And probably that's a key message to take away as well out of this conversation. But definitely, I mean, very exciting times really to be in the space, Lisa. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, it's a bit more personal, but what do you do on a daily basis to take care of your health?
So, so since I'm already in my mid-40s and I've been studying a lot about going into perimenopause, and so I've started to do a lot of weight training. So I do a lot of muscle training. I did never do this before, to make sure that I have, you know, really strong muscles to keep my skeleton in shape. Because once you go into menopause, I know that my bones will start degrading. My heart health will also go down. I mean, not just my heart health. It happens to all women after menopause. So I would say I'm preparing a bit for menopause by doing a lot of weight training and also move a lot, being very active to protect my heart and my brain. That's also very good for the brain, actually. So
that's, I do amazing. I love that. I think it's also very inspiring, and it's great to also think about that for anyone also, any woman listening to us. Amazing. Thanks so much, Lisa. And, you know, I think as final remarks, you know, there's some key sentences, right, that you share with us, right? Like the fact that we have generally assumed that women are smaller versions of men. We still have this big, big data gap in terms of women's condition. I mean, you put there an excellent example with endometriosis, perimenopause, that we barely know about it, prepare for menopause, etc. So really exciting times ahead. That's a bit also the takeaway I get from you. Although there's a lot of work to do with data harmonization and how to treat that, but really promising, right? What AI can do for us now and in the future. I don't know if you have any final remarks or messages that you would like to share today.
Yeah, I actually, because it's not only the AI. You know, what makes me the most excited about the future is all these young women that are driving this forward. Because in my generation, that was not, you know, somehow we didn't dare as much to have this drive. And you know, when you're sitting in this conference, you have this young women, they just go after their idea, they look for solutions. And it's not AI that will save us. It's this young women that are so brave and intelligent and are pushing. That is what will bring the change in the end.
I love that. Can I use this as a quote for the podcast? Like, it's not AI that will save us. It's these young women really driven who are going to smash it. And I absolutely love that, Lisa. Thank you. And just, I guess, how can the audience find you, like, online? And I mean, obviously, I told earlier that you are a book author, and I'm sure that a lot of people will be curious to follow you.
Well, you find me everywhere online, I'd like to say. No, but you can go to my website, lisafalco.com, and there you will find links to all my social media, and also learn a bit about my book, which is really explaining all these changes that the hormones are triggering in your body. It's not just about hormones, but it's about a lot more as well. And also links to, I write regularly for Forbes Women about women's health and femtech, and you'll find links to all that writing from my website.
Perfect. We'll make sure that we link it also in our podcast and socials. But Lisa, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast and to learn from you today. Very inspiring. Way forward. So thank you again. And I hope that we can catch up again soon.
Thank you so much.
Bye now.
Bye.